Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the April 25th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist, the host of the Capital Record podcast, the author of Full-Time, Work and the Meaning of Life, and of course, the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. How are you, sir?
I am good. It's a big week in USC news. Where do you want to start? We've got Reggie Bush gets his Heisman back. We've got the campus protest for Hamas shut down by campus security. What was it like?
Yeah, we've been covering a lot of SC lately because we had them boot the terrorist valedictorian, which it all at once, I want to be clear, just because fair and balanced. Congratulations on the valedictorian.
That's right.
Boo for being a terrorist.
Your parents must be so proud. Oh, no, they're not.
One thumb up, one thumb down. How's she doing in college? Great. She's valedictorian. Oh, God. She must be so proud. What else? She's in Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, she minored in resistance to genocide studies.
But then, you know, obviously the whole OJ thing, it's not really a USC story. I mean, OJ was a USC running back in 1967 and 68, and he cut Ron and Nicole's heads off in 1994. Was it 93 or 94?
94.
Why are you laughing? Why are you laughing about this?
Because you said I find decapitation funny. No, because I just love the juxtaposition. Can I be honest? Is that okay?
Yeah, what juxtaposition?
He played running back for USC in 67, 68, and then cut Ron and Nicole's heads off in 94.
Right, it was 30, almost 30 years later. It was like...
you're a bad man.
My point is that I don't think OJ was like really known at that point in time, first and foremost being a Trojan. Like there are SC Trojans that have stayed incredibly connected to the university.
Right.
Marcus Allen comes back for all kinds of games. Keyshawn Johnson's very involved. Some are even donors. Some have come back and coached. You know, Charlie White, who died last year, cancer. He was one of my childhood heroes. And Charlie came back and coached under John Robinson. OJ was a very big NFL star and a very big movie star. And I don't think of him as being part of the SC community. But by the time it was into the, you know, wife abusing and ultimately wife murdering years. But that's fine. He went to USC. So people, like, we've been hearing the OJ jokes about SC for forever. That I don't even know how we're on this tangent. It wasn't my intent. My point was we had an OJ story, we had the terrorist valedictorian, and now we have a good story. Because I think the other two stories are obviously really
bad. Yes, maybe you can give just a quick reprise, the Reggie Bush story.
Oh, you talk about a crime. This guy.
I am not going to get any coffee today.
This guy, them taking away his Heisman.
The NCAA.
And putting you, yes, the NCAA. And putting USC on those sanctions and essentially a very, very near death penalty type punishment for the university and punishing players from 2010 to 2012 for things that happened in 2004 that weren't even wrong. It's absolutely outrageous. And what happened is essentially that Reggie talked to some guys who were real dirtbags, and they said, we're running an NFL marketing thing. We'll help you out with some stuff if you agree to let us represent you when you go pro. Okay. He did not leave you. He did not come to USC for them. He left USC for them. And so there were major punishments against Alabama in the early 2000s and SMU in the 80s, you recall, after Eric Dickerson left. For money being given to players to come to the school, okay, which is now fully legal with NIL and everything. But at the time, it was not. He got a Chevy Impala that was worth $15,811, and he got a suit to wear the Heisman. And then his dad rented a house down in North San Diego County and didn't pay for it, allegedly. And then the guy came and blackmailed Reggie and said, you give me $300,000 or I'm going to...
And this is by the time he's in the NFL.
Yes, or I'm going to turn you in. And Reggie wouldn't pay the blackmail, got the FBI involved, and then everything came out. I believed all along that Reggie was wrong to not pay the blackmail.
Really?
I did. I think that what he should have done is paid the blackmail and then found some friends that took care of the guy another way. By the way, OJ was a free man at that point. So there were options. But I couldn't care less about him taking the car. Couldn't care less. Mm-hmm. I think Reggie created millions, not million, not thousands, millions of dollars for other people. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing cheating about it. It was not to create an unfair advantage at USC. It was
and also, the university did not know anything about
it. Nothing. They never turned over any evidence whatsoever. And they're saying, well, they should have known. And again, we're not talking about someone driving around with diamond earrings and a brand new Mercedes.
Right.
Okay, it was a used Chevrolet from the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a suit to wear to Heisman, which every single player has ever gone to Heisman's ended up wearing a suit somehow. Mm-hmm. The whole thing's absurd, totally absurd. But even if you just think, no, it's amateur sports and I'm a purist and mm-hmm. I don't feel that way about figure skating or gymnastics, but when it comes to black guys, I really don't like them getting mm-hmm. any money ever mm-hmm. in a sport that creates billions of dollars for white guys. If that's mm-hmm. your ethic, mm-hmm. then that's fine. but they punished the wrong people. Matt Barkley didn't get to go to a bowl game because mm-hmm. of this thing that happened 10 years before he was at USC. Mm-hmm. So then the Heisman Commission comes and takes his trophy,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, they didn't take OJ's, just so we're on the subject. People say OJ lost his Heisman. It's because it was sold in the civil suit collection.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you have people that have won a Heisman that have done some bad things, murder being one of them.
Right.
Some other stuff out there, too, I don't want to get into.
Mm.
Reggie wore a suit to the event he was getting an award at.
Yeah.
And got a Chevrolet. And they took his Heisman Trophy. So this long story is to say that this week he got it back. And in the immortal words of Ronald Reagan's labor secretary, who I believe was named Ray Donovan in the 1980s after he was acquitted and dragged through the mud for years in the media, they said, "You have your freedom." He goes, "Where do I go to get my reputation back?"
Yeah.
Fight on, Reggie.
Well, also at USC, just very quickly, big student protest yesterday. I did not put this in the show notes, but we can do this almost now by rote. Big campus protest in favor of Hamas, anti-Israel, divest from Israel, all that kind of stuff. And it ended up in a, if you see the video, it's an actual, there's a fight, there's a brawl between cops who are trying to get the students to move off the encampment and students who are fighting back. The coverage is just, sort of, it's vile and violent. It's a January 6th style riot from the left. Cops are being punched and have objects thrown at them. It's pretty terrible. So the campus is shut down. USC is at least temporarily shut down, perhaps through the weekend. Classes remote. Same thing up at Humboldt, which is now called Cal Poly Humboldt. I thought the kids up there were smoking so much weed that they wouldn't get this vial, but no, they have occupied a building, thrown up a bunch of furniture to blockade themselves in. That's a fire hazard. So the campus just shut down. And this is going on at Berkeley, UCLA. It's going on all throughout the college system. It seems to me that we have a viral contagious disease, and it's an idea about private property, about disrupting other people's lives, about death threats. It's a pretty difficult time. In good news, David, I want to just, you sent over a link to your, I think, wonderful presentation in front of a shareholder meeting. It was a short video. I'll put it in the show notes. Can you tell people what was going on with you and Truist Bank?
Yeah, Truist is a byproduct of a 2019 merger between BB&T, which is a big, big regional bank in Charlotte, and SunTrust, which was a big, big regional bank in Atlanta. So the two big, big regionals became, a mini major. They're not quite, obviously, at the size of your JP Morgan's and Bank of America's, but they're right below that. They're by far larger than all the other regionals. And so Truist is a company we've owned in my portfolio for a long time. I've been a shareholder personally for a long time. And they're acting like a bunch of knuckleheads. And I have a belief that as a shareholder, I have rights. I got that belief from case law. And I also believe that to a certain degree, within limits and bandwidth, I have obligations. And one of those obligations is to engage with management about things I think they're doing that are boneheaded. Now, if you think it's a bad investment, then you got to sell it if you're a fiduciary responsible for managing money for other people. If you think it's a good investment, then you got to not sell it. And then if they're doing boneheaded things, but you think it's a good investment, then that's where engagement comes in. So when management's doing everything right, we don't need to engage. When we don't want to own the company, we don't need to engage.
You just sell.
Right. Or never have bought.
Never bought, right.
Like, I do not do this with companies we don't own. It's just not, I don't have a dog in the fight. I got better things to do. But in this case, we own the company and we think they're being dumb. There's a guy, John Allison was the CEO of BB&T back in the day. He's a libertarian, wrote a book after the financial crisis that was outstanding. And he's done a number of things over the years to kind of stand up for free enterprise. He's a sort of a public thinker and spokesman. This was a CEO of the bank back in the day. You know the kind of cultural surroundings of North Carolina, Georgia, where they're located. They have a huge footprint in the South. And then they now have decided that going and being a little wokey-woke accommodator is somehow good for business. Mm. And they're sticking their thumb in the eye of different conservatives and Christians. And so I think they need to be reminded of who they serve. And in this case, I'm referring to their customers. And then, of course, by failing to properly serve customers, it hurts shareholders. So we engaged them. I have a consultant on retainer with our firm who takes these endeavors on. They're absolutely outstanding. Boyer Research, after about 8 meetings with investor relations and the C-suite, it was clear that they were not being receptive to what we were talking about. And we put a resolution forward, and I got to give a speech at the shareholder meeting. And last year, a rather high-profile thing happened with J.P. Morgan, and it created an incredible result to the point of them filling out the survey from the Alliance Defending Freedom about viewpoint diversity, making public proclamations citing my own resolution that they would not debank conservatives or Christians. Jamie Dimon has now gone on air 3 times begging left corporate America to understand the viewpoint of center-right conservatives, even if you don't always agree. It had a big impact. And Park Avenue, where J.P. Morgan's located, more or less telling their regional managers all over the country, if you debank, we will fire you.
Well, we left a bank at California Policy Center. We were with Citibank and pulled out. And it was in part because one of our board members walked into a local branch and saw the place festooned with BLM and gay pride flags and said, I'm just here to bank. Like, I just want to keep my company's money here and our checking accounts and our savings. And what's all this now? So we pulled and we're now with Farmers and Merchants. There's a free advertisement, I guess.
Well, and I've had the CEO of Farmers and Merchants on my other National Review podcast, Capital Record, Henry Walker. He's a friend. My business, the Bonson Group, works closely with Farmers in a number of capacities. They are an example of a fantastic local regional bank that's still family. It was family founded, family owned. Henry's the great grandson of the founder. But most people don't have that option. You can't bank at Farmers and Merchants, which was founded out of Long Beach, California, if you're in Birmingham, Alabama, or if you're in Indianapolis.
Right.
And so national banks are oftentimes the only solution available for people. And my Truist is a very large, although not quite national, but a super regional bank in the South. This isn't hard. You cannot get an F minus from conservative scorecards and an A plus from liberal watchdogs and say that you're not picking sides. And that's what Truist is doing. And saying they want to debank people on different sides of issues in the culture war. It's a very bad idea, bad for business. What you're referring to is Citibank in the marketing. I don't know of any allegations that Citibank refused to bank different people through this period, but then putting up signs everywhere. That's the other side of this culture thing, where the corporate America fits in the culture war, where they can kind of do something by not doing anything at all. Doesn't have it move the needle whatsoever, doesn't hurt anyone, help anyone, just putting a poster up. It's like the equivalent of a teenager posting on Instagram. So they put a sign up, they feel good, they put a picture with like 6 different races of people represented in the picture on the marketing, and they feel good about themselves. So, you know, now you say they had an LGBT thing. Was that a poster? Or did they have people in there doing stuff?
I wasn't there, but I understand it was flags and posters and, you know, the kind of thing that you see in front of an Orange County suburban home that says, you know, in this home, we love and we hate. Hey, David, I wonder if you'll...
And also the Nazis are the worst.
Don't tell anybody. We hate the Nazis. Unless they're for Hamas, in which case, like, it's all good and forgiven. Hey, March 31st passed without me noting for you, flagging the fact that that's actually Cesar Chavez Day nationally, but not to be left in the dust. Gavin Newsom on that same day, Sunday, March 31st, issued a declaration that Cesar Chavez is now will be memorialized every March 31st. It's Cesar Chavez Day. They usually call these like commemorative rather than holidays. So it's just like a day where we're supposed to commemorate. But it's almost like the Catholic Church where you have to go through these various stages of becoming a saint. So this is the march towards sainthood and a full federal holiday for Cesar Chavez. The thing that's fascinating is just a couple of things. I was reading a book about Chavez, I want to say a couple of years ago, by Miriam Pavel. The book is called The Crusades of Cesar Chavez. And she tells this story about his role in the late 50s. This is where he began to really learn his organizing chops at a group, a Latino group called Community Service Organization. Nice, bland, generic label on that. And she tells this story about how he's living in San Jose, Christmas is coming, and quote, he had a last-minute idea to use the holiday season to earn some money for the organization by getting Christmas trees in Oregon and selling them in California. And so overnight, Chavez drove nearly 600 miles from San Jose to Eugene, Oregon. Story goes on. He collects 900 trees, has them shipped back down to San Jose. And it's just, you know, one obstacle after another. But he finally gets the trees down there. And she says, in the end, Chavez only ended up selling about half of them. And the entire scheme put the organization in the hole, almost $300, an abject failure by any metric. What makes the story so typical of Chavez were not the abysmal results. It was how little he was deterred by them. One of Chavez's great strengths as an organizer was just this relentlessness, she recently told a reporter. We'll come to his story in a second. I mean, if you talk to people today who are good labor organizers, often it's just a matter of going back over and over again and just never giving up. So he failed and continued. That's his business expertise. But the thing that the story that I'm quoting from, which is in the Texas Standard, the National Daily News Show of Texas, I don't know it, but here's a reporter named Sean Saldana, and Sean Saldana writing a couple of years ago, points out that Cesar Chavez did not like illegal immigrants. This is not well known by people like Gavin Newsom, I imagine, or if it is, they try to suppress that information while celebrating what they do like about him. Imagine anybody else launching what Cesar Chavez called in the mid-1970s the Illegals Campaign, an effort, the reporter writes, an effort to raise awareness about illegal immigration and report undocumented workers to federal authorities. The effort was led by his cousin, Manuel Chavez, and reports began to emerge of Mexican immigrants being threatened, beaten, and robbed by Chavez's followers as they tried to cross over the United States. At one point, the patrol operation was so large it employed 300 people and cost United Farm Workers $80,000 per week in the 1970s. To Chavez, a civil rights leader who swore nonviolence, any influx of foreign labor represented a threat to his movement. The people who crossed the border illegally were in search of a better life, but they were also, the reporter uses this word, he says, but they were also scabs. Now, that's a ferocious word, I just want to say. I'm just going to say it's the N-word.
Oh, really?
Yes, of labor, absolutely.
Because scab used to be, I guess this was labor. I didn't think of it that way. It was when the NFL had their strike and the players that would go play.
That's right. It's anybody who breaks a strike and is considered to be the most...
N-word's a little...
I'm sorry. No, this is their word. They mean it and they use it ferociously. It is the worst thing they can call someone from the union side. I'm not saying for you and me, but I am saying for them in labor, this is dehumanizing.
But they'll use the word.
Yeah, the word.
They don't say, like, you're an S-word. So, like, it obviously isn't exactly the same thing.
No, because we won't say the N-word. Yeah. You know, here's a quote from Chavez at the time speaking to KQED, I think it is. Yeah, KQED, the famously left-wing radio news station up in the Bay Area. He tells them in the 1970s, all of a sudden yesterday morning, my guys brought in 220 wetbacks. These are the illegals from Mexico. There's no way to defend against that kind of strike breaking. So he's... he is a guy who is very complicated. You know, I was raised to think of him as primarily a Catholic activist. That's how I was raised in kind of the social labor kind of ideal of Catholicism.
Well, with a liberation theology.
Well, that came later.
Okay,
yeah,
later.
Yeah. My parents
may have flowed out of it.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. This is they merged and then they suppressed information like this. You know, Chavez becomes this monomaniac about illegal immigrants, telling people at one point, "Why are we not winning this strike over here against the lemon growers? It's because of those damn illegals who are coming across." So this is how, you know, goals change over time for the labor movement and language changes, and then we begin to memory hole some of the information. And there's Cesar Chavez, and there's another more approximate reason to mention him today, and that is that, well, I should mention him 2 days ago. On Tuesday, April the 23rd, that was the day that Cesar Chavez died in 1993. April 23rd, 1993, Chavez dies. His Memorial Day, as I say.
How old was he when he died?
65.
Okay, so then I don't know the answer to this. It's a serious question, but it doesn't seem like I'm being funny, but it's serious.
I'm going to laugh. I'm not drinking.
Was the Julio Cesar Chavez that used to fight Oscar De La Hoya his son or his grandson?
That I want to say it was a grandson, but I know
he was only 65. Probably, because if they each had each other in the 20s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was thinking it was his grandson, but if he dies in 93, very easily, I think.
Yeah, but right? I mean, he was fighting in the 90s.
That's a good point. That could have been his son then.
It
yeah, I don't know.
Could have been son or grandpa.
Yeah. Not a big boxing fan. Sorry.
All right.
So
I was just so we can understand the difference between Will and I've always loved sports. Will likes sports as well. Will was studying California history forever in preparation for this podcast. Before there were podcasts, Will was studying to be ready
for this podcast.
I didn't know that Julio Cesar Chavez had a famous relative, the labor guy, was more famous than the boxer. I didn't know that till after like the second fight with Oscar De La Hoya. But so this is.
Well, thank you for putting that fine point on it. Hey, in distressing news about Kamala Harris, and this is just one of those, you know, terrifying moments that becomes just a little comic for reasons I'll explain. But Kamala Harris has a Secret Service detail. I don't know if you saw this story. It just came out yesterday. It was broken by, I want to say his name is Tom Rogan at, where is Tom? I want to say he's at The Examiner. And anyway, he breaks the story that one of the Secret Service agents who is assigned to protect Kamala Harris goes nuts, goes after his supervisor, attacks him. After repeatedly warning the Secret Service's higher up that this guy was unbalanced, he's still on the detail while the staff are preparing to get Kamala Harris off out of D.C., join Andrews, Joint Base Andrews?
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I always get it's an unwieldy name. But this is just a couple of days ago. In fact, the first reports came out yesterday that this agent goes nuts and it says here, after, let me see. It's kind of interesting to see what happened here. The Secret Service agent exhibits distressing behavior Monday morning at Joint Base Andrews and was hospitalized. Harris was not present. He began displaying behavior their colleagues found distressing. The agent was removed from their assignment while medical personnel were summoned. He began spouting gibberish, was speaking incoherently, and provoked another.
I'm sorry, is this him or Kamala? Because I've seen some videos.
It's contagious.
All right, so what was wrong with him? Because
They're not saying. They're saying that he was mentally unhinged.
Well, I believe it, but like didn't they say he was just saying silly gibberish?
Gibberish.
Kamala
speaking
does it every day.
That's right. But I don't think she actually attacks her boss.
I mean, serious right now. Not being funny. Did he have a stroke?
They're not saying. They are saying that medical personnel arrived. Can you have a stroke and still fight somebody? Like, he went full rogue on these guys. This sounds more like, you know, that cannibalism craze that swept Florida when people started sniffing bath salts or something. He starts fighting his
supervisor.
How
old is this guy?
They don't say. A lot of information when this story comes out.
It sounds maybe drugs or alcohol or something.
Could be. Mental illness associated with that or separate. You know, the story's all helpfully.
All right. I got to pay more attention.
It's a weird story.
I don't know why this is a story. What are we talking about? It's not on you. Why are we talking about this guy?
The only reason I'm talking about it is because it's close to Kamala Harris, and okay. You already made one link between the incoherent babble. got it.
And, oh, okay.
And I hate to make up anything. But the other one is interesting is that buried in one of the stories is where she was going. So we have Secret Service detail. We have Air Force Two, I think it's called. Is that right for the VP?
Yes.
And she's going to New York City. I'm trying to find out why is she going to New York City? She was going to appear on the Drew Barrymore show. Wow. Thank God, because there's nothing else going on. That might be the highest level need for her right
now.
That
show's still on?
I had to say to my wife, is there a Drew Barrymore show?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so in more serious news, just want to point out a couple, one more thing here, that Kamala Harris tweets out a couple of days ago. This is on Monday. Today, I announced new federal actions to address staffing shortages in nursing homes and help raise pay for home care health workers. What is she talking about? She's talking about the fact that the Biden administration, through Health and Human Services, that's Javier Becerra, who is our once our future.
Breaking news, Will.
Please.
USC has canceled the whole graduation ceremony.
Oh, my gosh. No kidding. Read on, McDuff.
So the anti-Israel protest intensified so much because of canceling the pro-terrorist valedictorian that now USC has called off the whole graduation ceremony.
Wow. Right action.
Four years. 4 years of college, graduate,
yeah,
and it's called off because of these knuckleheads.
Yeah. How often do we allow these things to spin out of control, like COVID pandemic shutdowns, so that, you know, just among millions of other kids in America, my daughter got to spend her 2 years in college sitting on a computer in her bedroom at home. Back to Kamala Harris, if you don't mind. Monday, she announces this big new federal action to staff up nursing homes and to help raise the pay for home health care workers. She writes, care workers provide our loved ones safety, dignity, and self-determination. They do God's work. First time and perhaps last time you'll hear her say those words. God's work, caring for us, and we must care for them. So the HHS rule under Javier Becerra, that'll become salient here in just a moment, is this, David. The controversial mandate requires that all nursing homes that receive federal payments, like Medicare and Medicaid, provide at least a total of at least 3.48 hours of nursing care per resident per day, including defined periods, blah, blah, blah. That means a facility with 100 residents would need at least two or three registered nurses. They have to have a registered nurse now in the facility. The nursing folks who, you know, the people who run this thing said, like, look, man, nobody meets this new standard.
This is, why is this federal jurisdiction? Because if they receive Medicaid?
Yeah, that's it. They leverage that. If you accept cash from us, then we get to determine your business
model.
Well,
yeah, but you also have to take the cash.
That's right.
So it's not like if you take the money, we're going to have rules, which in theory I could get behind.
Sure.
But you have to take the money.
That's right.
Well, that's an interesting.
I think, yeah. Well,
you know who else does that? I met a guy once named Big Tony.
There were rules associated with payback. That seems weird for a guy named Big Tony.
He said you had to pay him.
That's not right. But that's just unfair. Yeah. Joe Biden has a word for people who make people pay back their loans.
Did you see his pause thing?
No, what was this?
He was giving a speech yesterday and he stopped and said pause on the teleprompter and he said pause. I just stood there. No, it's a true story.
Was he just referring to a cat that had wandered onto the stage?
He just paused.
We paused.
And then he kind of looked and people started applauding and he just kept talking. It's all over the internet. You should...
Oh, pay attention.
It's tough to follow things like that when you got Cesar Chavez's.
On my brain, yeah. So here's the CEO of the American Healthcare Association responding. He says, while it may be well-intentioned, the federal staffing mandate is an unreasonable standard that only threatens to shut down nursing homes, displace hundreds of thousands of residents, and restrict senior access to care. Issuing a final rule. And again, this is a rule. This is not legislation. This is how we now govern. We govern through rules made by agencies that are unelected. Refer here to footnotes about Chevron defense. Issuing a final rule, Parkinson continues, issuing a final rule that demands hundreds of thousands of additional caregivers when there's already a nationwide shortfall of nurses just creates an impossible task for providers. The unfunded mandate doesn't magically solve the nursing crisis. So this is, again, magical thinking on the part of our good old Kamala Harris. And who did Harris meet with while she was making this announcement? The leaders of SEIU, Service Employees International Union, who she congratulated for pressuring the government to act. She sat around in Wisconsin. I want to say it was Milwaukee, but I'm not 100% sure of that. La Crosse, I'm sorry, in Wisconsin on Monday. This is about dignity, she said. It's about the dignity that we as a society owe to those in particular who care for the least of these. Again, this kind of biblical echo, the least of these. We have...
I love their selective quoting of scripture.
Yeah, always.
You know, like the least of these, and then you're like, well, what's tomorrow? It's LGBTQ day.
It's just a cafeteria, the Bible. It's a bunch of recommendations. So I could go on. She met with SEIU officials to make this bold announcement that a federal agency was going to make hospital care and care for the aging almost impossible. This is what they did, David, with AB 257. Again, it was SEIU, raised the minimum wage from $16 to $20 an hour. Everybody knows the story by now. And you and I had projected for 2 years from the time that bill was first introduced that this would lead to job losses, store closures, price hikes. And everybody called us, well, certainly called me, a fascist, a MAGA extremist. I was making stuff up. I was a fabulist. And now we find out that all those things are true. And it's not because I'm brilliant. It's just because I know that 1 + 1 = 2, and you can follow the rules of gravity and with regard to economics. Hey, the big story this week, I think, not Chavez, not Kamala Harris's announcement, not Reggie Bush even, David, sorry. It's the Grants Pass decision went to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
This is, of course, the big homeless case. Here's how Ryan Mills at NR sums it up. In the 2022 Grants Pass case, the Ninth Circuit Court ruled 2-1 that the small lower-income city of Grants Pass, Oregon, can't enforce anti-camping ordinances, quote, against homeless persons for the mere act of sleeping outside with rudimentary protection from the elements or for sleeping in their car at night when there is no other place in the city to go. That case, Mills continues, that case came on the heels of a 2018 ruling in Martin v. Boise, that's Boise, Idaho, in which the Ninth Circuit similarly held that enforcing criminal anti-camping restrictions on people who don't have access to temporary shelter violates the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual. Here's the thing, David. This case goes to the Supreme Court, Grants Pass does, and the media immediately come out and say all kinds of good things about the liberal majority. They note that at least one conservative, Samuel Alito, seemed to side with the liberal minority. In asking questions about why the city will not simply, what are these people supposed to do if they're not allowed to sleep here in public? They did not ask, why are people sleeping in public? Mm. How did they get there? And the answer is, you and I have talked about multiple times, probably to the mind-numbedness of our dear listeners.
How did they get there?
They get there because 87% of them, by most studies, somewhere between 85 and 90% of people who live on the streets in California are there because of mental illness and or drug addiction, often both. If you don't start off mentally ill on the streets, you frequently end up that way. And the only way to sort of calm the voices sometimes and the terror is through drug use, rampant drug use, which becomes sort of the culture of these encampments. More on that in just a moment. But it was left to just a couple of these. Let me just cite from a couple of these folks here who said, here's Sandra Sotomayor, who says when the lawyer for Grants Pass said, look, it's just not compassionate to allow people to live in squalid homeless camps. She replies, neither is providing them with nothing. Yeah. So you are responsible, sir, for providing them with the housing they lack. And then you've got, others. I won't even go into all of them. But you have Alito saying, doesn't a person have any alternative other than sleeping outside? They have none. They have none, he says. Mm. All of this ignores... I think an increasing realization that because of the culture of these encampments and how people really end up on the streets needing a place to sleep and can't find one is because of the mental illness and the drug addiction, and sometimes both. And a lot of this is about the lawlessness that allows somebody like that to continue to live on the street. And I'm not just talking about just letting them live on the street, David. I'm talking about the fact that California, specifically, with 12% of the country's population, has a quarter, 25% of its homeless population, 150,000 people. I'm sorry, 50%. Sorry, wrong number. We have half of all homeless people in California. Half of them in the United States live in California. Am I clear on this? Let me say it again.
Yeah, you are clear now. You said it wrong about five times on the way to getting there. Sorry. I was pretty sure I knew where you were going, and you landed.
I landed there finally.
50% of the homeless in America are in California.
Yes.
And obviously, the only statistic that matters is that adjusted for population.
Sure.
What percentage of the population lives in California, in America, is in California? Mm-hmm. I think it's 16%.
I have 12.
Mm-hmm. Is that right?
That's what I count, yeah.
Well, aren't we still about 50 million, 48 million?
38 million, 38.5.
38 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've fallen a little bit. We were at 39.5, just about to crest 40, and then something happened. And I don't know, black box. Couldn't tell you what happened.
So about 12% of the population's here and 50% of the homeless. And then you could say that it would be a little bit better apples to apples to compare it to a similar type density of population, just in terms of the differences mm-hmm. in homelessness in, let's say, some of the Montanas and mm-hmm. South Dakotas of the mm-hmm. country. But there's no possible way, soaking wet, you're going to get to a like common type population adjusted of higher than 25%.
Mm-hmm.
And we're at 50.
So that's right.
So this is a problem that really, I guess, begs for an explanation.
Yeah, and I think the explanation that you do not see in the questions from the court, in the protestations of the attorneys on either side of the Grants Pass decision, the best, by the way, I think the best question came, let me see if I can find it, Chief Justice Roberts, he asked, why do you think these nine people, talking about the justices, of course, why do you think these nine people are the best people to judge and weigh these policy judgments? I think he's saying, why did you make this a federal case? It seems very local, and I would agree. The answer is that California voters have voted for politicians and for ballot initiatives that have really shredded the criminal defense, the public safety of Californians, and created the conditions in which people who want to live on the street and pursue drug use, who will tell you, I don't want to go into a facility for treatment because they will impose rules on me, just starting with sobriety, never mind the rest of it. They don't want to live by the rules of, let's just call it, normal society, so they're going to live on the streets. And Californians have made it possible for them to do that because there's a business model. The mm-hmm. business model is you can steal up to $950 without incurring a felony.
$949.
Thank you.
At $950.
$950 it triggers. Thank you. So at $949, you're still good. And you can live on the street reselling some of the things that you steal.
I'm just curious. How do they account for sales tax and sale prices, like if it's marked down?
You know what? I've never
asked. So like if it's a 50% sale
right.
and you steal $1,700, uh-huh. that's $850, you're good.
Yeah, you're still in the ballpark, I would say.
So really, there's a lot of things you can do with coupons.
That's right.
Okay, let's ask that. What if you steal $949, but then you have like a buy two, one, get two free deal? Do you get... I'm just asking for the law here. Is this too much to ask?
I think you need to fund a policy research
paper.
Why
is this even absurd? Where the guy can show a DoorDash ticket and squat in someone's right. property for a month and everyone acts like this is a
That's
real...
normal. Yeah. You've got more news? All right. Well, here's the answer. So we get that in 24. We get Prop 47 in 2014 that reduces the criminal punishments. And I was talking to our friend Jim Palmer, who is the founder of the Orange County Rescue Mission, recently retired from that amazing organization, also on the board of California Policy Center, full disclosure. And Jim says, like, look, man, in the old days, if you committed a property or drug crime, you went to jail. And sometimes that interruption in your life got you enough clarity that you would clean up. But we also had drug courts. We had courts that Gavin Newsom wants to recreate, but which have been absolutely unable to serve people who don't want to go through drug court with an 18-month program, for instance, when they're not even going to go to jail for stealing $949, right? So if you're not going to face any real punishment for stealing and engaging in public defecation, public drug use. These are all now misdemeanors under Prop 47. Mm-hmm. We've also got the defund police movement of 2020. We've got Jerry Brown's prison realignment back in 2011. That's what sent, Brown wanted to save money because of the Great Recession. So he sent a bunch of closed a bunch of state prisons and moved prisoners back, inmates down into county jails where they were ultimately released very quickly because they were considered quote unquote under Prop 47, low level offenders. years. They had their cases reviewed, and if they had felony convictions, they just sent them back out on the street after having reviewed their cases. So Prop 47 unleashes hundreds of thousands of people who would otherwise have to sort of face the music for some kind of property theft and or public drug use or whatever. No more, as Palmer says. So the real problem here is itself Prop 47. And, you know, fortunately, I would argue that we've got now, thanks to Representative Kevin Kiley, who's a congressman, represents a part of rural, Sacramento County up there, I think. Maybe it's Placer. Rockland. There we go. Mm-hmm. Took me a moment. He's in Rockland. But he's leading the reform Prop 47, repeal Prop 47 campaign. So we've got some hope. But until you fix that business model that allows people to live on the streets in squalid conditions, really asking where these people are going to sleep is like the housing first model. Gosh, if we just built these people houses. Speaking of which, I just want to point out, here's a story from Santa Monica that the city council there has approved a $1 million per unit homeless housing project. Did you see this story, David? This is from April 10th. City council voted to approve a 122-unit apartment building for the homeless that'll cost more than $1 million a unit, making it one of the most expensive affordable housing projects in the nation. It'll be financed with federal, state, and county funds, loans, tax credits, and tax-exempt bonds. The council could have chosen to strip all labor protections, but we've identified these as priorities, one of the council members said. So we're going to have union labor working on this. That's part of how we got this thing over the line. And the most.
So it's 122 units, and does each homeless person get their own unit?
I'm not sure. It's they're talking about single rooms and rooms for two people.
But they're going to spend $122 million to house 122 homeless people?
That's what they say.
What?
Yeah.
I don't think that's right.
That's what they're saying here. It's $1 million, the project, 122 units.
And 116 underground parking spaces. So yeah. What are the other six going to do with their Mercedes?
Yeah, the other stipulation that, people in Santa Monica City Council, it's just such a blast. You can listen to them online, and it is, just hyper ridiculous. But here's one of the.
What's the 19,000 square foot grocery store? Are they going to have cash registers, or is that a pro bono?
I don't know. It's going to be free, perhaps. You can get anything you want up to $949 for free. But in all seriousness, that first floor market, they said, would be serving the surrounding community. That is the non-homeless community will be dining, eating, shopping beneath four floors of street people. They're talking about having outdoor dining there. I do not want to dine beneath four floors of street people. I'm so sorry.
No, I disagree. I think that's very
prejudice on my part. Yeah.
Do you happen to know if Caroline Torsis voted for it, or you don't have that?
I do not know.
Because it's funny. I would normally assume when you see this quote in an article, council members acknowledge the eye-popping cost of the project. Quote, I have rarely seen a project with this price per unit. It's only going to get higher.
That's right.
I would presuppose that someone who voted against it, but I'm not sure she did.
I think she did. I think she's part of a little group that is fighting, a more moderate group called Change. What is it called? Change. It's up here somewhere. Santa Monicans for
Change.
But
then why this guy says it went way up in cost because we're adding 62 two- and three-bedroom units.
There you go.
We could max out the density and put in 250 studios, but I don't think we as a council or a city want that. See, this is the part I understand. All of this to me is just absolutely outrageous. But is what they're saying, we want 128 people to stay homeless because we're worried about the growth
density,
we're worried about the global warming and the just traffic and the other.
That's right.
That's what they're saying.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Can you imagine living your life in that way? That first, there's two things I can't imagine going on right now, and one of them, my friends on the right are often guilty of, which is saying, oh, I'm worried about the growth that will come from 250 units, just to hell with all these people, okay? But the second is generally only something I would see from people on the left, which is that we need to solve homelessness by spending $150 million of taxpayer money on something that is not going to solve homelessness.
That's right.
But if one believed that, if you believe we need to spend money to house the homeless, And then they go, we're cutting off our count at 122 because if we went 250, it's going to... You are saying, not by my logic, by your logic, your rules, you're saying I want 128 people to stay homeless.
That's right.
That's absolutely outrageous.
Well, there's a great piece that's it's just total comic parody almost, but it's in the Free Press. Barry Weiss's news outfit out of Los Angeles, which I highly recommend to people. Barry Weiss is not a conservative, but she is a awakened, formerly progressive Democrat, a liberal. She's the person who famously, reporter, editorial person who famously left the New York Times under a just storm of outrage by the progressives on staff that she would entertain conservative opinions in the editorial pages of the New York Times. But she, I'll put this in the show notes. She runs a great video by a guy who went to the West Hollywood City Council where a similar meeting unfolded. And you have all these progressives. He notes that the meeting starts off with a land acknowledgement. You know, that's a thing where somebody stands up and says, we acknowledge that we live on occupied land. That belongs to the Gabrielino tribe. Yes. And then they proceed to talk about how they're going to dispose of this land for all kinds of great projects. Yeah. But it's in West Hollywood. I lived in West Hollywood for a brief moment. Won't tell you the wonderful stories about living in West Hollywood. Seriously, some of them great and some of them just really terrifying. I learned why women don't always like men. Being in a gay town like West Hollywood and being a young man in my early 20s, going to graduate school and being a runner in dolphin shorts in 1986, you can imagine. But anyway, my point about West Hollywood is this guy videotapes speaker after speaker coming up saying, look, we really need to take care of the homeless problem. But not here.
No.
Not in our town.
No.
This is going to increase traffic, right. Its density. One guy actually...
Smog
is back. Yes. One guy actually says that these are not the quality people we want in our town, or the right. quality of people. Like, that's the elitism that gets Trump elected, I think. That kind of BS double standard that just infuriates normal people.
Well, it's more or less the problem of most white liberal women.
Continue.
I don't have anything else to say.
Period.
I'm saying that like I've told the story before about the summer of 2020 that it was our first summer that we owned our house in East Hampton and having been locked down in California for a little bit and going back to the city, and the city was largely still kind of locked down in the summer, but we were out in the Hamptons a lot that summer and it was the BLM summer.
Hmm.
And every single store, every store I went to in East Hampton had a BLM sign, everyone.
Wow.
I never, the entire summer, saw a single black person.
I was going to ask. Yeah. Yeah.
No.
It would seem to me that it's that the Hamptons, just in my mind, are a very sort of class-based residency, that you live there
well,
if you've
it's
got
a
some
very,
cash.
It's a very wealthy enclave. I mean, there's people who have been there a long time. There's a ton of history. It's very, very charming. It's not a stuck-up type feel. It's a lot of farms everywhere, and it's just absolutely gorgeous. But it's let's just say that there are certain constituency of white liberal women. I don't know why I got to keep finishing up after this.
Well, I'm just thinking that the problem that you're probably pointing to is that white liberal women tend to, what is it? They practice what they do not preach. They probably are all about BLM and all about gay pride flags and protest and
unless
riots.
Unless it comes at any kind of cost.
Right. Yeah, that's it.
This is a message from our friends at American Habits from the State Policy Network. We the people. Do you ever think about what that means and what happened to it? We the people certainly did not mean an imperial city full of unelected bureaucrats deciding everything from kindergarten curricula to nursing home funding formulas. We the people mean self-government, a free people deciding most things in their families and communities and delegating some authority to their towns and states while passing along just a small amount of that power to the national government. How did things get so upside down at American Habits? We tell stories of real people with real solutions, all working to restore federalism and self-government. If you're a public official, come get involved. If you're a citizen, come and see the new standard for American leadership. No matter who you are, come help us renew the forgotten but not lost habit of American self-government. Visit AmericanHabits.org to learn more. That's AmericanHabits.org.
Okay, so we got to move really quickly here because we're coming close to the end of our time together, but... I just want to talk about one last thing here about abortion and Gavin Newsom. Newsom, Arizona famously votes, or the Supreme Court formally decides they're going to go back to some like 1864 law that bans all abortions completely unless the life of the mother is at risk. Gavin Newsom finds this outrageous and jumps into the fray as quickly as he can, drafts an amendment to a bill in the California legislature that would allow Arizona doctors to treat their patients, that is to carry out abortions in California. He's doing this as quickly as he can because the legislature in Arizona is already correcting this. But Newsom needs a fight with other governors in red states or redder states. I wouldn't call Arizona red anymore. But so he's passed this bill. You can imagine the theatrical drama as Newsom and Nancy Skinner out of Berkeley run around rushing to help the women of Arizona, but they're being beaten already by the legislature, which is moving to go back to the state's former restriction, which said, I think, 15 or 16 weeks. So Gavin Newsom jumping right in on the Arizona contest. Let's just talk really quickly. Can you, David, what the hell is going on at Tesla? We've got two stories here. Tesla and Fisker appear to be in kind of danger. Fisker looks like it's going out of business, frankly.
It's funny how that works.
California carmaker Fisker, once worth $2.9 billion, warns of looming bankruptcy. Here's another headline. Tesla lays off more than 3,300 California workers, mostly in the Bay Area. Any sense of what's going on with the electric vehicle industry, and especially as it pertains perhaps to California and these California companies?
Well, it's not a specifically California story, but I mean, Tesla was at $360 a share almost in December of 2021, so about 2.5 years ago. It's now at 170, so it's down a tiny bit over half. And you're talking about that being a $1 trillion, you know, market cap at the time. It's, you know, you're $500-600 billion. And that's the good one. That's the only one that actually sells any cars and makes any money. That people don't want them, can't afford them. They're too expensive to make. Battery life is not good. Battery replacement is expensive. The whole economics of it were never fully thought through. And China can do it a lot cheaper. And they are competing quite a bit on the overseas side of sales. And then these other Johnny-come-latelys, which it's a totally different category, with those other types than with Tesla, they just said, we don't make any money. So,
yeah. All right. How about if I let you go? If you don't mind, would you give me 3 minutes in the studio here? And I'm just going to talk directly to the listeners about some media criticism. I'm going to let you go because I know you got a hard stop here. But I wanted to talk to the listeners about two stories that I found and I find kind of fascinating as epiphenomena of the journalism world go. One is that Andrew Scheler, reporter for Sacramento Bee, I reached out to him for an explanation on this story. His headline last week was, "This California School District Passed a Forced Outing Policy." That's Andrew Scheler language and the far left's language for any policy that requires a school district to notify parents that their child is using different pronouns, different name, asking for official changes in their school record, asking to, you know, boys asking to play on girls' teams, that sort of thing. He calls that forced outing. But now, he reports, this school district, which is Murrieta Valley Unified School District, is backing down. He leads the story this way. A Southern California school district that passed a policy last year requiring that parents be notified if their child uses different pronouns or a different name while at school will not enforce that policy. In a message to parents and students last week, Murrieta Valley Unified School District wrote, quote, "An administrative regulation has never been developed and the policy has not been implemented nor enforced." That doesn't mean that they are walking it back, as Sacramento Bee's Andrew Scheler says flat out in his headline and in his story. So I emailed Andrew, who I've had a couple of interactions with, mostly asking him, why is it that you use the phrase forced outing when we are simply talking about a school notifying parents? Is it forced outing when the school calls me to say, hey, your kid wants to play football, that's going to require a physical. He wants to go on a field trip to the zoo, that's going to require a signed note from you. Your son needs to watch a movie in biology class, will you sign a note? But not if my child wants to change his gender. That's a bridge too far for people like Andrew Scheler, for the California Teachers Association, and its various local affiliates. But I asked him how he knew this, because I knew something about this, that the school was not backing down. That, in fact, the very next day, the day after Scheler writes this story, I knew they were going to have a vote and it was likely to reaffirm this policy. And I told him so. I even offered. I said, hey, Andrew, you know, my education team at Cal Policy Center knows a little about this. You might want to just check things out with us before you go. You don't have to report our position. You don't have to even adhere to it, of course. You're free to ignore what we say, but you might want to do what we say in the journalism world, which is if your mother tells her she loves you, check it out. He did not. He instead declared that this was a fait accompli, and he was cockadoodling the victory, citing all these people who said this was an outrage to begin with, so glad they're backing down. But then, of course, as I say, 24 hours after he writes this story and it is published on the SACB, the council votes 3-2 in favor of affirming this policy. So, does the SACB print a correction? It does not. Does Andrew Scheler follow up and write a story about the actual vote? He does not. So you got your kind of Dewey defeats Truman moment if you're a SACB reader. And I would say your skepticism about the Sacramento Bee ought to spread more broadly. This is a paper that clearly just has taken the leash off every reporter. There's apparently no editing going on, it seems. I mean, if somebody can get around writing something like forced outing in a headline, which is purely political language, that is absorbed from the progressive left, but primarily from the California Teachers Association. That's not reporting. That's just propaganda. Similarly, a story in the Fresno Bee. This one's even funnier to me. Here's the headline. Clovis schools now more LGBTQ tolerant, union says. Here are the latest changes. Well, the story tells us that teachers can fly pride flags and students can change their pronouns at school without parental notification, according to a union statement detailing a new agreement between school psychologists and Clovis Unified School District. Now, that's the opening paragraph of the story. When I went back to print it out, David, for our conversation, David's now leaving. Bye, David. There's an update that immediately precedes this that statement I just read. Update. Clovis Unified School District spokesperson said the district is not changing its policy or procedure. She said there will be a document drafted with more guidelines for the personal items on display policy, which could include how and whether pride flags can be displayed. But she said the parental consent will still be required. Okay, so the entire story, which ran under the headline, Clovis schools are now more tolerant, has been updated to say no policy has changed. Why do I point out these two stories? Is it just to pick on these two reporters? No, it's to suggest that what they mean to me, just as an outside observer, is that newspapers have become captive to a kind of progressive left political agenda. And I'm not saying entirely every reporter, but I'm just saying generally, these papers are willing to print as news, as fact, statements which are so certifiably untrue that it doesn't take a fact checker. It just takes a careful reader to go and read something else. You don't have to be, you know, me with an education policy team of five people. I can make a phone call to them, although that's what I did in fairness. You can just sort of read and think through these things. And it doesn't mean that all media is bad. Like, you know, I would be a hypocrite if I said, well, I'll never read from the SACB again, or I'll never read from the Fresno Bee. But what I like to tell people who say, like, what can we read? Read everything you can get your hands on, but always bring a compass. Always bring a moral compass. That's all the time we have today. Thanks for spending your time with us. You can always find Radio Free California on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and better for us if you just subscribe. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you do subscribe. That boosts our profile, and that helps others find and join this band of brothers and sisters. And of course, I don't know whether Sarah is going to pop in the advertising read from Rich Lowry. So I'm just going to say this. I'm going to be among more celebrated National Review contributors for two National Review Institute events here in California next week called Foundations of Freedom: The Importance of America's Constitutional Pillars. The speakers include Janice Rogers Brown, former California Supreme Court Justice, National Review editor Rich Lowry, the magazine's editor Ramesh Panuru, UC Berkeley law professor John Yu, and me. The first of these conversations will take place in Newport Beach on April 30, and the second on San Jose on May 1st. They'll run from like 3:00 in the afternoon, I think it is, until 5:30 or 6, with cocktails and conversation afterward. Registration details and precise locations are in the show notes. I hope to see you there. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to Session producers Lucas Klaus, Brian Tong, and Glenn Hall, and a National Review podcast producer Sarah Schutte. Thanks also to Metalachi, the LA-based mariachi and metal band, for our music. Thank you, Lucas, for sticking around during this long stem winder of a close. And remember, la revolución continúa. When does it continue? En la semana próxima. Adios.
We'll be right back.